This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Earlier this year, we told you about a law passed in the state of Massachusetts that gives the Massachusetts Department of Elementary and Secondary Education authority over any virtual schools that begin operating in the state. At the time, there was only one such school, and that's about to change.
That was part of the concern we had was we really didn't know what we would be getting into.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear why a virtual school is literally closing. We'll also hear about a project in New York's Hudson Valley that teaches diverse populations how to develop, write, and ultimately perform their life story in front of an audience. And we'll spend an academic minute trying to figure out why our memory is so weird sometimes. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Recently, the school committee of the city of Greenfield, Massachusetts, voted unanimously to discontinue the Massachusetts Virtual Academy at Greenfield Public Schools. It is the only operating virtual school in the state and is now scheduled to shut down on June 30th. The Best of Our Knowledge's Lucas Willard reports.
The decision comes ahead of new state guidelines designed to expand virtual learning in the Commonwealth, signed into law by Governor Deval Patrick in early January. John Lunt, chairman of the Greenfield School Committee, said he was unclear of how any of the 10 virtual schools to be created under the new law would be regulated.
Most of the regulations around the Commonwealth virtual schools that have been created have not been promulgated as of yet. So that was part of the concern we had was we really didn't know what we would be getting into.
The Massachusetts Virtual Academy at Greenfield was initially established after 2010's State Innovation School guidelines were created. Currently, 475 students from across the Commonwealth attend classes via online learning and in-home instruction at Greenfield's Virtual Academy. Mitchell Chester, commissioner of the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, was unavailable for comment, but stated in a memorandum sent to the Board of Education that the January law signed to expand virtual schools comes from the board's 2011 position that there should be a stronger oversight and consumer protection role for the state than the one provided by the Innovation School statute. John Lunt of the Greenfield School Committee said that if the Massachusetts Virtual Academy were to be awarded a certificate to operate as a Commonwealth of Massachusetts virtual school, it would operate essentially as a charter school and with a loss of local control from the public school district.
An innovation school under the innovation law that was passed several years ago allowed for districts to operate a virtual school with local control to hire teachers to make sure that they were all properly certified, to make sure that we were aligned with Mass Core curriculum standards. The new law creates a charter school that has a separate board of directors and is, by its nature, and it's written on the DESE website, meant to operate independently of a public school district.
Department of Education guidelines state, similar to the charter school model, a CMVS is an autonomous school district that operates independently of any existing school district. Marcia Day, another member of the Greenfield School Committee, also opined via email that she has no issue with the concept of expanding the curriculum beyond the school district's physical borders, but that the new model is similar to a charter school. Greenfield Public Schools Superintendent Dr. Susan Hollins was not available to return a call for comment, but spoke in support of online learning after the January law to expand virtual schools was passed. She said that it was not the intention of the Greenfield Public School District to create a model for virtual schools in Massachusetts.
It was never the goal of Greenfield to stimulate 10 virtual schools. Whether or not there were ever any other virtual schools wasn't really our interest. Our interest was making sure there was a virtual school for some of Greenfield students and also students around the state who absolutely needed an option that was not inside a public school building.
The Recorder of Greenfield reports that after last week's committee meeting, the superintendent had wished that the committee had taken more time before its final vote, but that she respected the decision. The Greenfield School Committee Subcommittee on Innovation Schools is scheduled to meet with the public to discuss the future of the virtual school at Greenfield. I'm Lucas Willard.
The TMI Project is a nonprofit organization that offers memoir writing workshops that culminate in staged true storytelling performances. Their slogan is Changing the World, One Story at a Time. This past year, after receiving a grant, they launched the TMI Project Community Outreach Initiative, which brings the TMI Project to underserved populations. The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue recently sat down with Eva Tenuto, the executive director, and Sari Botten, editorial director of the TMI Project.
We started TMI Project in my living room after directing the Vagina Monologues a couple of times for a fundraiser for a local organization. The third year, they wanted us to do it again, and we asked if we could tell our own stories this time instead of the stories of other people. And we just got together and wrote our own life stories, and that was how TMI was born. But I never expected that we would even do it again, necessarily, or that it would turn into this community outreach initiative or any of the things that we've got going on. But it has just snowballed, and I'm running after the snowball and keeping up.
But you have help, obviously, in the running after the snowball.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's funny. In the car on the way here, Eva said, we've had so many requests for community outreach, I can't even remember which ones to tell you. It's been really amazing.
So Eva, when you look at the success, what does that tell you about us? That not only that we have this want to tell our stories, but we also have a desire to hear them.
I think that we started this project at a time when people are not talking to each other that much anymore. You know, with the increase in social media and right. texting and all of the different ways that we've been able to communicate for convenience, the regular old conversation and intimate connection has kind of fallen by the wayside. And people are really intrigued by just hearing someone tell the truth in a way that I didn't know was going to happen. And it keeps happening over and over again. Every time we do a show, I'm blown away by the impact that it has on the audience and the people who are telling the stories both.
There's also this identification that happens. And the person who's telling the story gets to feel like people identify with them, and also the audience, like they identify. And so there's this exchange that happens that you don't really have like on Facebook or even just talking to your friends. Most of us don't really tell these parts of the stories that we're encouraging people to tell, the TMI part.
What becomes, as an editorial director, what becomes too much information that is good and too much information that is bad?
Well, we try to tell people, first of all, we always tell people that we are not therapists and we're not equipped to really help them through certain things.
Although this keeps growing. Put one on the payroll.
Yeah, we thought about that. But we try to get people to, well, one thing, we don't let people talk about crimes they've committed that are unresolved. We try to get people to not talk about things that they're going through that are really, really charged at the moment. We refer them to therapists.
Yeah.
So if there's something that people are currently in crisis about, it's not a great topic to bring to the stage.
It's too fresh.
And one of the things that you need to have to be able to tell a story well is some time to reflect on it and understand what your part was in things and what is the revelation. If you're currently steeped in it, you can't have a revelation about it. So we try to pick pieces that are still important to people and still important to tell, but not something that's currently going on.
But the TMI part that is good is, you know, we want people to talk about the things that have embarrassed them or have been painful, because the people in the audience have had those same experiences, and they want to know that they are not alone, and also the person telling the story. So it's the painful, embarrassing stuff that you usually leave out.
We have, I think, as a culture, and certainly what Eva was saying earlier about technology and blurring the lines of communication, and I certainly understand that and agree with that. However, it does seem as though with the takeoff of memoir and of autobiography that we as an audience and we as communicators have become more comfortable with that concept of sharing intimate details of our lives.
Definitely, definitely. And I think it's a great thing. There are so many critics of the whole genre of memoir, and I just, to them, I say,
foo.
Pish posh.
Yes.
Well, we've also seen generations of people suffer from not talking about things. You know, I mean,
right.
People who've suffered from addiction, sexual abuse, things that are generally thought of as shameful, and they keep it to themselves, and it gets passed on from one generation to the next. And we've got people that we work with who say, I'm telling this story because I want my daughter to know that it's okay to talk about this if it happens to her.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that we're learning that it's important to talk about what's happening.
It's curious because I think people learn, they learn in a very, in a small petri dish, if you will, of where something will happen, which can be as traumatic as the family pet dying, and then talking to other people and realizing how emotional that can be for other people. And you say, okay, I'm not the only idiot who's crying my eyes out over this.
Exactly.
Or I'm not the only person who's ever had a panic attack, or I'm not the only person
right.
who 2 years after my mother died can't get out of bed.
Exactly.
So when you bring that out to a larger audience, it really does.
It's amazing what
people tap you on the shoulder.
What people say after the performances, I mean, people come up to the performers and say, I had the same experience. Thank you for talking about that. That's like probably the most common sentence ever, you know, said at the end of our performances is, thank you for telling that story. It's my story, too.
You know, one of the things we just did with the Community Outreach Initiative was we taught a workshop at the Mental Health Association in Kingston. And the participants there did a show at the end in the cafeteria, and it was open to the public. And it was so well attended and popular and got such great reviews that they asked us if we would do that show again so other people in the community could come. But one of the things that happened at that show was people who have been diagnosed with mental illness got to tell their stories. And a woman in the audience came up to me afterwards crying and said, everyone should see this show. When my son was in his 20s, he committed suicide, and I wish he had been able to see people like this talk about what they actually went through and got to the other side before that had happened. Thank you so much for doing this. And being able to give a community of people who are often unheard the chance to be able to be heard in a powerful way was really moving. It was one of the most moving experiences for me as a director to be at that performance.
Because we so often think of stigma.
Mm-hmm.
Of no matter what it is.
Absolutely.
Of that somehow we will be perceived as damaged or as unable to cope or as not strong. And yet what you ultimately understand is how forgiving isn't the right word, but understanding and supportive people are.
Well, that's why we say that that's why our slogan is changing the world one story at a time, because we want people to address those things that are stigmatized and help people see them and understand them differently so that eventually they won't be things for which people are stigmatized, that eventually people will not make fun of people for those things, that there won't be bullying about these things because people will hear from the people who have those issues and understand them. We want to foster greater understanding among people.
Because if you put two people in a room and you have one person tell their story about something that happened in their life, the common reaction for the other person is to say, oh my God, well, what can we do? I mean, it is most people aren't horrible, right?
Right.
Even if they've done horrible things, they're
right.
Mostly not horrible people.
I mean, it seems like we're hardwired one-on-one to be sympathetic to those things. And yet, as a group and as a society and as a culture, we will often have these lines that say, okay, I have to act this way against this type of behavior.
Well, because when they're not talked about and people are embarrassed about them, they become even more stigmatized when they're not discussed.
Yeah.
I love seeing the kinds of friendships that come out of the TMI class.
Mm.
I see people connecting and having relationships with one another who I never would expect would be able to relate. I'm just thinking about in the last workshop, there's a man who's considering transitioning genders who became very good friends with a woman who just got out of jail for dealing drugs. And the likelihood of that pairing happening in the outside world is pretty slim, but they hug
each other. It'll be a fly on the wall for those conversations.
They
right?
hug each other after every class. It's amazing.
Yeah. And when you look at what you try to achieve with this workshop, as it becomes a retreat, so that's very immersive, isn't it?
It is. And when we did the first one, I wondered, are we going to be able to pull this off in 2.5 days? It's a lot of opening up right away. And we do end the workshop with a performance on Sunday evening. They can invite friends and family, and they do a polished monologue.
Yeah, like a 7-minute monologue.
But what we do is we bring in some people who have gone through the workshop already, and they do their monologues to get the workshop started. And then the participants can ask any questions that they want about the process, how they got to their end result, what they went through to tell their story. And within that, they start opening up, even though it's about someone else. And by the end of Friday night, people are already telling stories. By the end of Saturday, we almost have a piece. And Sunday, we just polish it up.
It's amazing how quickly the women bond, especially after hearing the stories of the prior participants. They just immediately start opening up and bond, and it's like a big slumber party.
And I assume that comes out of safety. It comes out of protection, that this is a place where you can do that.
We have a set of guidelines that we use to set the space up as a safe space right from the beginning. We do it with every class that we work with, regardless of which population we're working with.
Yeah, I think it really helps people to feel like they can express themselves when there are rules about how you respond and that kind of thing.
Still to come, Joe's conversation with Eva Tenuto, the executive director, and Sari Botten, editorial director of the TMI Project, continues with a look at a new phase of the project. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1173. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guests today are Eva Tenuto, the executive director, and Sari Botten, editorial director of the TMI Project. They're speaking with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue about the project, which teaches people from diverse populations how to write and tell their personal stories and perform them in front of an audience. Now there's a new wrinkle to the project, having people who don't want to perform write and publish their stories.
Yes, we're going to be publishing things now.
And that is that's powerful as well.
It is. And it also allows people who don't feel like getting up on a stage to share their stories. And it allows us to have a broader reach because people can buy this who can't come to the theaters we perform in.
And it also gives some writers anonymity. You know, we have some populations of people that we're going to be working with who are not in a position where they can say, this is me telling my story, because it would be dangerous. Like
right.
Women who have survived domestic violence, or
sure.
Some of the boys that we're working with at the Highland Residential Center who are incarcerated. There are too many repercussions of sharing their stories.
We went to an LGBTQ teen workshop, and there were kids in there. There was a kid who has not been out to his parents, who's a Boy Scout, who's not out to the Boy Scouts. He wants to share his story. He can't get up on a stage and tell it because it's going to get out. So we are also going to be publishing a collection of essays from the different populations in the Community Outreach Initiative.
Eva Tenuto is the executive director, and Sari Botten, the editorial director of the TMI Project. They spoke with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue. You can learn more at tmiproject.org. So how come you can remember your friend's Facebook status but not a piece of fine literature? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Profound statements tend to stick with us, or so we think. But as Laura Mix, senior research fellow at the University of Warwick, reveals, social media is providing us with a real grasp for the mundane.
Social networking sites, such as Facebook and Twitter, are incredibly popular. People post their thoughts as microblogs over 30 million times an hour on Facebook alone. One would not expect casually written posts to be remembered better than words penned by professional authors and edited by professional editors, but that is exactly what we found. In one experiment, people memorized Facebook posts or sentences from various books. They were tested on those items and items that they didn't see, and indicated if they saw or did not see each item previously. We found that Facebook posts were remembered much better. One might think that the sentences were just particularly hard to remember, but when we compared Facebook posts to faces, the same finding emerged. The posts were much more memorable. So what's happening? Could it be that when people are tasked with memorizing Facebook posts, they naturally encode them with respect to people they know? And for that reason, the posts would be remembered better. For example, I may see a post and think, that seems like something my sister would write. We tested and ruled out that explanation. Could it be that microblogs stand alone, whereas sentences from books do not? Or could it be that microblogs are more gossipy in nature? We found some support for both ideas, but neither idea was sufficient to fully explain the remarkable memorability of microblogs. It seems that with the growing popularity of microblogs, written language is moving closer to natural speech. Perhaps the differences in memorability were so pronounced because the unedited, unfiltered emanations of the human mind resonate with the recipients. In other words, casually generated language comes to mind easily and is easily remembered. Facebook posts or tweets may be discounted as trivial, but this form of communication can provide a glimpse into how memory works.
That was Laura Mix of the University of Warwick. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.